Okay, so thank you all for joining us on our call. This is Dr. Will Tuttle, and it is July 16, 2015, about 6 p.m. here in California, and wherever you are in the world, 9 p.m. on the East Coast. And next month, in August, the third Thursday in August, we will be in Europe. So I've been contemplating that a little bit, trying not to think about it too much, because I think in Switzerland it's 3 a.m. So I know there are brave souls who get up at 3 a.m. to listen, so I guess I might have to be that kind of a brave soul next month, although I have to figure out how I'm going to do that with Madeline's 95-year-old mother in the same space, I think. We'll figure it out. So anyway, thank you all for joining us again, and this is the World Peace Diet Circle. We are dedicated to deepening our understanding of the ramifications of our food choices and how our routine violence and abuse of animals boomerangs in all kinds of ways, and how we can not only thrive as vegans in a world that is not yet vegan, but also how we can be effective advocates for animals and for a better way of living on this planet. And there's really, as you all know, an enormous amount of room for growth in the understanding these ideas, and more than understanding them, I guess, in living them. So this is a great opportunity that we have, I think, to join together on the third Thursday of every month. Everyone who's in the World Peace Diet Circle, which is open to anyone who would like to participate by registering online, and also to people who are going through the World Peace Diet Mastery Program and Facilitator Training Programs as well. So, and they're all archived at worldpeacemastery.com, I guess, /conference. But I always send out the link to that. So everything is archived as an MP3. You can listen to 50 prior events that we've had online, monthly events, going back several years. So as we usually begin our time together, I'd like to say a couple things just in the beginning, that we are really dedicated also, besides just hearing me talk, if you have questions or comments about anything that is related to veganism and the World Peace Diet, and the spiritual dimension also of ahimsa and vegan living and of your life, and anything that has to do with any issues or questions you may have, or any victories you may have had, or any sorrows or problems you're facing that you think would be helpful to get some insight into, this is your chance. The phone code to press is *6. If you press *6, then I will be able to see that you have raised your hand here, and I'll be happy to unmute your phone. Otherwise, all the phones are automatically muted when you join us. All right, so this is great. I'm so delighted to have another opportunity to speak with you and to discuss some of the issues that are facing us. Every month it seems to be a whole different quality of time that we spend together. It's always wonderful, but there's different issues and things that are coming up all the time, and different opportunities as well. So Madeline is in Switzerland right now, so she's not here giving me something to drink or whatever. I have to do that on my own. By the way, I think we have a video online. If you want to have a fabulous summertime drink, I highly recommend the verbena stevia tea. Some of you may have heard us talk about that before, but it's really, it's just remarkable. I'm making it myself. Usually Madeline makes it, but I also like to make it when she's not here. It's so simple. You know, you plant a verbena plant and you plant a stevia plant, and they're only a couple of dollars. You can buy them, I think, at most any nursery or anywhere, and they're a perennial bush. So once you plant them, and you can plant them in your yard, or if you have a porch, or if you have anything at all, they can grow. and I've just been amazed at how healthy they are and how they love to just need. They only need a little bit of water, and they can tolerate a lot of sun and rain or whatever else. And they just put out, especially the verbena, a huge amount of leaves that you just cut a few branches and take some stevia, which are these other green leaves, and cut a few of those branches and kind of put them down inside of a pot and add some hot water. Or you could also do it as a sun tea, just put it in a jar and put it out on the deck or somewhere in the sun and let it warm up that way, and it'll automatically create a delicious tea that you can then just keep adding water. It's amazing how you can keep adding water to this and just last and last and last for a few days at least. You can put it in the refrigerator at night if you want to keep it cool. Anyway, we drink this constantly because it's good to stay hydrated in these hot summer days, and also there's some kind of magical healing power, I think, to herbs in general. And this is a really delicious one. And you can use, instead of verbena, you could use peppermint or a variety of other things, I'm sure. Stevia just gives it kind of a natural sweetness without any sugar. All right, so enough of that. But it's delicious. And as we usually begin our time together, let's turn our attention within and feeling our connection with the beautiful planet that we are all on right now, that we are connected to, the living web of life here. Perhaps we can see around us trees, or we can see sky, birds, perhaps bushes and flowers. Perhaps we can see water of some kind. And we give thanks for this precious connection that we have to the web of life here. We give thanks also for our connection with the infinite spirit, which is the source of all life beyond any concepts at all. Feeling our connection through the earth and through heaven with each other and with all of the others on this earth who are working so diligently in their own ways to help raise awareness, to help bring peace and freedom and justice, joy and abundance and equality into our lives here as human beings and for all living beings, that we may celebrate our lives. We give thanks knowing that we're part of an awakening of human consciousness on this planet, that we are awakening to our purpose, to celebrate our lives and to grow in wisdom and compassion. And we give thanks also knowing that all the ripples that radiate out into the world from our being together on this call for this hour or so, hour and a half maybe, will be ripples that go out into the web of relations to bring peace and healing to everyone who's touched by them in any way. We give thanks to everyone in the past, everyone in the present, and everyone in the future who is part of this movement of awakening and of healing and of understanding at a deep level the truth that we are and the truth of the interconnectedness of all life and of all living beings. We understand that there is no higher or lower or superior or inferior in the divine unfoldment of life, in this living web of life. And we send love to all expressions of life. And so it is. All right, well, thank you, everyone. And I'm just, again, delighted to be able to have our monthly call and to share ideas and inspiration and any questions that you may have. So, again, press *6 if you just join. A lot of people join a couple of minutes late. And so if you're just getting on the call, remember that you can press *6 if you'd like to raise your hand and ask a question or make a comment. And so, let's see, last month we had a few things that were kind of remarkable. And, of course, one of them was that we had a chance to talk with our friends and longtime colleagues, Mark Stroud and Anna Ferguson, about their really quite a monumental undertaking that I think has been fermenting and has been being worked on diligently for years, actually, for years, in Cincinnati and the community there. And I don't want to, obviously devote the whole thing as much time as we did last time, but I think it is important for us to keep abreast of what's going on with that project that they're doing. And I'd love to talk to them a little bit more about what's going on and then talk about, of course, I have a whole lot of other things that I really would like to talk about, too. Lots of issues and things that are percolating. I just got back from almost a week, 6 days in New York, in New Jersey, and being at animal sanctuaries and just really seeing the movement growing. I think it continues to grow in exciting ways. And I think Mark and Anna's project is a manifestation of this growth. It has specifically to do with the World Peace Diet vision of veganism. And as you all know, I guess, there's veganism and then there's World Peace Diet veganism. You know, there's I'm sure there's other types of veganism as well, but the World Peace Diet version of veganism is specifically focused on the biggest possible picture so that we're not merely vegan for animal rights reasons or health reasons or environmental reasons. We include those, but it's really specifically about seeing the larger connections, the intersectionality of oppression, the connections between violence towards animals and the problems and dilemmas that we face, the injustices that we force upon each other, and the war and violence that we experience both in families and communities as well as in nations, and then also to including the spiritual dimension, that we're not afraid to question the materialism of our society and the over-reliance upon a logical, positivistic viewpoint, to realize that there are, in many ways, dimensions of reality beyond what can be measured. The material, physical dimension of life is in many ways the outermost level, and that real change comes from getting beyond that to the deeper levels of understanding. And so Mark and Anna, of course, as you probably all remember, are involved with yoga movement, and Anna has started something called World Peace Yoga. And I've been to, Matt and I both actually have been to World Peace Yoga a number of times, and to the Jubilee that they put on every year, or have been putting on every year, and Mark is intimately involved with that and with putting on World Peace by facilitator courses, and also Mark is a well-known culinary award-winning chef. And so there's a cookbook that they're coming out with, as well as a yoga book, as well as, and I'm writing things for that, and so Madeline has recipes. And then so we're really supporting what they're doing because I think it's a great thing, and also they're interested in creating a line of vegan foods that are gluten-free and sugar-free as well. That'll be called World Peace Cuisine, I think, or World Peace Diet Cuisine. So I think what I'll do is go ahead and they've started a campaign to raise funds and to spread awareness about what's happening. And so I'm going to go ahead and unmute Mark and Anna's phones since I can see that they are with us here, which is exciting. And let's see here. I think I made a little mistake. Okay, there we go. So, Mark and Anna, are you with us?
Yes.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Mark. Good to hear your voices, and I'm glad to be able to talk to you both.
You want to tell
everybody what, if there's any news since the last time we talked and how things are going.
Things are going well. We've reached 10% of our of our goal and the campaign. So we really thank everybody on this call and just thank everybody in the world that's participated so thus far, those that have actually contributed and those that feel compelled to share as well. All of that is a contribution, and it's a amazing virtual, physical collaboration, and things are moving along. We deeply appreciate it.
Yeah.
Great. So, so is there anything else you'd like to share about what you're doing, what the purpose of this is, or what your vision is? I mean, we'd love to hear more. I mean, I think it would be good to see a little bit more sense of it since, things that perhaps have clarified a little bit, too.
Sure. Besides these particular projects, the cookbook, the yoga book, and the World Peace Diet line of food, really to just have different avenues to spread this message. So, it's not all on your back. We're just really encouraging as many people as possible to see this as really direct action. I think there's a movement right now, especially in the animal rights area, for people to want to go into a restaurant, stand up on a table and talk about the cruelty to our fellow animals. And I totally think that that is great. And at the same time, especially what I'm seeing is for a lot of young activists is that for some, anyway, that vegan education isn't necessarily seen as direct action. It doesn't have that in-the-moment kind of drama. So we're really appreciating that those that see like participating in campaigns such as this and other campaigns and other vegan, empathetic, compassionate ventures of all kinds are really people just to jump on board with great enthusiasm and to show how there's so much power in the numbers of the collaboration of people that really had that energy and that mindset, that level of spiritual vibration. So that, because what you said earlier in the call is so true for us, that this really is a global spiritual awakening, something that's never really been done in the history of mankind. And so it's really going to take all of us together, really supporting all of these different activities and seeking them out. So that's a real important part of our campaign, not only support what we're doing, but also it's a real clarion call to support others and to not to sit back and wait for them, but to seek them out and to initiate them and all of us together to make a huge difference. I just got a message from a woman that I don't know, we're Facebook friends, but she's from Armenia, and she asked me to look at her campaign on Indiegogo, and they're actually in the process of raising funds to open the very first vegan restaurant in all of Armenia and the entire country. So, what a cool thing that is. So, of course,
great, yeah.
Enthusiastic to support her and be part of that and feel that we're just as much a part of it as she is, and even though we're so many miles away.
Wow, thanks. That's very interesting about the, I really like what you're saying, because I think sometimes we tend to forget that we, although I don't think we can forget for too long, that we really live on a critical period in our history where if we don't make massive, basic, fundamental changes toward really adopting a vegan way of living, then we can't go on this way with eating animal foods. It's just absolutely impossible what it's doing to our inner world, what it's doing to the outer world. And so you're right. I mean, I think it's really important for everyone to remember that not to panic about it, but to realize that this is such an important, there's nothing more important than this, to raise awareness about bringing a positive change to our relationships with animals and nature and with each other based on ahimsa or nonviolence in veganism. So how do you see your project keying into all this?
How do we see it? What was the last part?
Fitting in and supporting all this.
Supporting how do others support, or how are we supporting?
Like, if you could maybe just say a little bit more about what your vision is of your Indiegogo campaign. Like, what you really would like to accomplish on the big picture.
Oh, the big picture. Well, the big picture is we just finished last week the last class. It was a vegan cooking class, which is part of the teacher training program, or the spiritual training program, that goes on for a year, 1 weekend a month. And I asked them on the first weekend, I give them a questionnaire, and it's the same questionnaire that we use for the World Peace Diet Study Group. And one of the questions is, what does a peaceful world look like to you? And it's interesting, when we give that to the group, it's usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 people or so. When they get to that question, they just kind of glaze over, kind of drop their jaw. They just don't really know what to say. And a year later, I asked them this question this past weekend, and they all wrote 500-plus word essays and then shared them with the group. And their transformation and what they came up with was just so heartwarming and so fascinating and so inspiring that it was of course different from each person, because they shared it from their own personality, but the message was the same. And so really what we are liking to achieve from this, and the big picture, the name of the campaign is World Peace at Tipping Point. And I was speaking with a business consultant at the beginning of our campaign, and he said, well, do you think you're at a tipping point with this? And I said, well, I believe that world peace, that this spiritual global awakening, is at a tipping point. And he said, well, then proclaim it and declare it, because it is. And so for us, it really is the vision of a peaceful world where
right.
we really have this kindness and generosity and appreciation and empathy for all beings, all our fellow animals, the planet, each other. And that's really what it is.
Great. Yeah, that's World Peace at Tipping Point, the idea is that we are approaching, or we're at the tipping point where we'll be able to reach critical mass, that idea, and be able to have a major change.
So we're actually in the midst of it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And
great. If anyone has any questions or any comments on this, please press *6 for Anna or for Mark. Anna, is there anything you'd like to add to anything at this point? Or
Well, in terms of, you know, just speaking to what Mark said already, just that we really obviously do believe, just as you do, Will, that world peace is possible and practical, and that the steps to get there are not, are really pretty simple. And, of course, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's slowly but surely happening. And the more people that get on board with this and more changing, I was just reading an article today about how hip-hop has gone vegan, and just all these artists that are making the shift and the transition. And so there's definitely more awareness, and we're imagining just through this campaign and putting more tools out there to make it accessible for people to go vegan, whether it's knowledge or of how to prepare food, or spiritual practices such as meditation, or the actual food itself, food product, that making things more accessible makes it easier for people just to make that transition. And the more that's available, it's just more mainstream. So
right.
So yeah, we're just really enthusiastic to. And actually, that reminds me that Stick and Afia, Stick of Dead Prez and his wife Afia, they were at the last Jubilee, and their Dead Prez's latest album, Information Age, is really amazing, and it speaks, I don't know if how many people have listened to it, but it really speaks to our culture's conditioning, and like, I'll just give an example of a track, and this is like, the hip-hop audience that's being reached is... there's a track called, I think it's called Dirty White Girl, but it's all about drinking milk and how it's horrible for you. So they found this, another like creative way to bring this vegan message to the hip-hop community. And anyways, they are actually endorsing our campaign and behind it, and there's a video we just posted today with a rap that Stick wrote about Mark's food and recipes, and also there's an endorsement for the yoga book by Stick and Afia as well.
Yeah, actually, one of his lines is also about the science of the world peace diet.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, actually, maybe I can pull it up and read it. It's not very long.
Okay.
Let's see.
Yeah, they're really great collaborators. I think that's one of the things that we've learned in the process of just over the years, and particularly this campaign, is that it's possible to find collaborators in the least likely places, and so just be open to that possibility always, and it's just let the door open and let the universe stream in, we're all surprised when we allow that, what comes our way.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
So yeah. I'll read this, and you can also watch the video and listen to it as well. Fast food is a killer, so bad we should riot. True health is our wealth, this fact we can't deny it. I've been through it, so I'm biased, had my life changed by it, so I bear witness to the science of the world peace diet. I take action with compassion, for health and for ethics, I salute Mark Stroud for his culinary efforts. Soul food for the spirit, so good, so healing, no unnecessary violence, just a deep love feeling. From the plate to the heart to the soul one feast, smells good, all together, let's eat for world peace.
All right. Well, that's great. Good to see it coming out in all these different ways, isn't it? Yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Terrific. Wow. So, how much longer is the campaign going to be going?
It goes through August 2nd.
A couple more weeks. Okay, so,
We're a little over halfway there. And so we will definitely request that everybody out there, if they're able to contribute pre-order a book, a yoga book, or the cookbook, or any of the other perks. And there's one perk, I think, as low as $3, and then there's one as high as $1,800, which is a lovely weekend with you, Will, and Madeline, of course. And then there are a lot in between. And, of course, if that doesn't work, we just ask, please share it with others, because it's amazing to find people who just don't really know too much about this, but just sharing the information with people. I know one time one teacher of ours shared some work that we were doing with a congregation. It was, I think it was a Presbyterian congregation. And a woman in the congregation said, you know, I just really believe in what you believe in, Jenna. And she wrote out a check for $1,000, and we've never met her in our lives. So it's always great to ask, and things turn up in the most unlikely places.
Right. Can you say just a couple, before we probably should wrap it up here in a minute, but could you just say a little bit about the World Peace, is it World Peace Diet or World Peace Cuisine, what your vision is for that?
Yeah, World Peace Diet Cuisine. We're starting off with a chocolate brownie that's gluten-free and sugar-free, and we're just really liking to make everything as sumptuous and delicious as possible and as healthy as possible. So we're taking the toxicity out, and sugar being one of those things, processed sugar in particular.
Right.
So that'll be the first of the line. And we're open to suggestions, but we're looking at other areas that different products, such as a sugar-free syrup that without any harmful side effects. So there'll be some things that are pre-made and packaged, and there'll be other things like the syrup that'll be staple. But we just feel that as many opportunities as to get the World Peace Diet name and associated books, products, those are the things that we're really focusing on. But I'd love to see a World Peace Diet line of clothing, for that matter, that was made out of sustainable, free trade, fair labor ways of manufacturing. So the whole idea is that more and more people are seeing these things and seeing this image and using these tools and in their lives on a daily basis. And what better thing than we do than to eat three times a day every day. So whether it's a cookbook that allows people to prepare food on their own and local and buy from local suppliers and so forth and so on, or products that are from local farmers and produced with a fair wage and fair trade. I think the more and more that, if you go to any city in the United States and you look at how many vegan, vegetarian restaurants there are, and then you look at how many there aren't, we've got a long way to go. So the more cookbooks, the more restaurants, the more products that are vegan-centric and the vegan lifestyle, the more the better. And it's our dream to see these kinds of things on every corner, and it's just, it's part of our vision of world peace.
Right. Okay. So the World Peace Diet line of food would be something that could be possibly available in Whole Foods or stores like that, or maybe through the internet, or just
Definitely be available via the internet and be able to be shipped, as well as reaching out to Whole Foods. And we plan to nationally launch the food.
Uh-huh.
So just like the books, it'll be widespread available.
Right. Uh-huh.
And everybody just gets a sneak peek of the first line through this crowdfunding campaign, because the brownies are one of the perks. So it's a brownie bundle peace pack. So
So for a brownie bundle peace pack, you get not only a couple of books, but you also get a brownie sent right to your door, which is sounds
exactly
great. All right. Well, so I think I hope if anyone has any questions, just press *6, and we can continue on with the main part of the call. And thank you both so much for making. You know, it's really inspiring to know that you've been putting on World Peace Diet facilitator training there for about 8 years, I think, in Cincinnati, and now this next whole wave of products is coming, the two books and the cuisine line of foods, and who knows where it'll go from there. But we're looking forward to continuing to collaborate and work together on things. And thanks so much for joining us. It's been great.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and probably mute your phones. But you know, if you want to say anything more, just always feel free to press *6. And, I think it's very inspiring to see that when we work together, we can really make a dent in the armor of the herder culture, right? You know, there's a couple of different words that are used, I was going to mention this, maybe I'll just mention it briefly, to describe the culture that we're in and the mentality of the culture that we're born into. The words it was coined, I think, about 25 years ago, speciesism. So we were born and raised into a speciesist society where speciesism is like racism and sexism and so forth. It's discrimination against beings of other species. And then there's another word, Melanie Joy coined the term karmism, which is sort of similar to speciesism and the idea that we're born into a society where we have this invisible ideology that animals are just here for us to use however we want. And both of those terms, I think, are helpful, you know, and it's good to have words that describe, and they're very similar to each other. I think speciesism is sort of an invisible ideology also, like racism and sexism, that we, in a sense, inherit, like we do with racism and sexism from our society. And now I've gone ahead and coined a third term here, which is herderism. And the reason I like that word is it actually explains it a little bit, whereas the other words don't explain anything. But herderism explains why we have this kind of a mentality, and it's based on owning animals as property for food, primarily, and for other objects, with products and objects, which is really the foundation of a herding culture. And as you all know, that's part of the the teachings of the World Peace Diet, that we live in a herding culture. It's very difficult in many ways to recognize that because herding cultures in our minds look very different. They're more pastoral, and people are living sort of out on the land with their animals. But a high-tech herding culture is what we have, where the herding is industrialized, basically, and the animals are hurt, not so much herded as they are just merely confined. I mean, herding was another name for herding is confinement. Animals have always been confined by herders, either by dogs or by fences or by just sheer numbers of people, kind of keeping them in a certain area, or by putting hobbles on them, or doing something so that they can't move as they normally would, because animals normally would try to get away and they want to live freely. And so we herders have always had to devise some kind of a method to confine them. And so we, as the technology has developed over the centuries, we've gotten really, really good at confining these animals. And then pressuring them to produce more growth for flesh and dairy products and eggs and other honey and so forth for us to use. But the violence towards these animals continues to increase. So herderism is a mentality that's injected into anyone born into a herder culture, that we are vastly superior, quantum level beyond animals, because we're so superior, because they're just property that we own, that they're we can harvest them like we would harvest fruits or whatever, and that their suffering at our hands is not an issue. It's just not a problem. We just don't worry about it because we're herders. We are herders. And so I think most people don't, you know, it's kind of a shock to perhaps to actually realize that we're born into a herding culture, and that society is organized around owning animals as property for food and other products, and that we're injected with a mentality that is not in our best interest, because it reduces our capacity to feel and to make connections and to really see what we're doing. And because it goes contrary to our true nature, which is to make connections and to not harm others without some kind of a necessity. And so now that we're aware, actually, you know, 10,000 years later, that we do not need to eat animal foods to survive, okay, that's a huge realization. And we don't, there's no one needs to eat meat to get any nutrients that we need to be healthy. So, I mean, why has that basic understanding not percolated out into the society? Because as soon as we understand that, you know, maybe 10,000 years ago, for some weird reason, people were in a situation, it was very dry or very kind of environmental devastation happened, and people just needed to herd animals to get enough to eat for some reason. But that's absolutely not the case today. We do not need to do that. And I'm living testimony of that, and I'm sure many, you all are too. You're all vegans, I'm sure. And, you know, as a vegan for 35 years, running around without any problem. I just on Saturday, I ran up a mountain in Catskills, you know, and I think I was the only one running up and down by far. They said it would take 3 hours, and it only took me 1 hour. So anyway, so the point is that it's not necessary to eat animal foods. We can be just as healthy and probably a lot healthier without it. So we have no need to herd animals. We have no need to cut down forests, to overfish the oceans, to grow all these genetically engineered crops, to feed these just billions upon billions of animals who are living miserable, horrific hell realms that we've forced them into. It's absolutely unnecessary. How do we live? How is it possible that we live with ourselves while we're doing that and it's completely unnecessary? And how is it that we're not able to awaken out of the cultural trance that we're doing this and it's utterly unnecessary? In fact, we're even continuing to spread this through Cargill and Monsanto and Kentucky Fried Chicken and Burger King and the whole complex, the agribusiness and pharmaceutical and food industry. It's a huge corporate financial structure that is spreading that profits a few and is devastating to everyone else. And the question is, why don't the people, the masses of people whose lives are harmed, whose arteries are clogged, who get diabetes and obesity and dementia and such misery, whose world they're seeing being polluted, whose water is being polluted, whose water is being depleted, whose climate is being destabilized by the devastation, why there's people are going hungry, people are starving, 20,000 children a day are starving while we're growing enough food to feed these people, but we're feeding it to animals, which is driving the conflicts and the war that is killing our children and taking huge amounts of petroleum. Which is causing us to go to war. I mean, what in the world is happening that we don't just have the ability to educate ourselves? You would think that if one person figured that out and told another person, the cat would be out of the bag. I shouldn't say such a thing. The tomato would be out of the bag. You know? So everyone would know. We would just say, look at this, you know, and people would, you know, the word would spread like wildfire, and people would just never again go back to that dark insanity of eating the flesh of tortured animals and feeding it to their children and the secretions of these animals. And why in the world is there this feeling that anyone who's a vegan is dangerous, and I mean that feeling is, fortunately, I think it's decreasing, but there's still that underlying idea. I think it's very interesting to look into this, and of course, to answer these questions is really why, in many ways, I was driven to write The World Peace Diet, and I guess in many ways, while we're having this call, to try to understand this basic, obvious absurdity of the fact that it's completely unnecessary to be eating animal foods for us today, and yet we keep this monumental industrialized killing machine in place and feed it with our dollars and with our lives, really, and with the lives of our children and grandchildren, and don't ever look up and question it. It's really astonishing. And I think you can see why there are some movements like Direct Action Everywhere where they're just, you know, sort of going in and yelling at places. There are restaurants like Chipotle and Whole Foods, and places like Whole Foods, where I guess they think people are more open-minded. It's not food, it's violence. We try to break through the numbing, although I really don't know if that helps to break through the numbing. I mean, I know it probably perhaps helps a few people, but I'm wondering if it doesn't perhaps also reinforce within people that, oh, there's these crazy people that don't understand that this is delicious and this is what I always ate and this is my identity and this is what we do. And so I'm not sure if that's effective. But I do agree with Mark and Anna, and I'm sure all of you, that education is the most important thing we can engage in. What form that education? I mean, that's a form of education. I think what Direct Action Everywhere is doing is a form of education. And I'm not criticizing them. In fact, when I went and spoke at their headquarters in Oakland a few months back, you know, quite touching, really, that they all, a number of them said that they were inspired to get into this work by reading The World Peace Diet, and that they would actually buy World Peace Diet copies used and just give them out to people. That was part of their what they would do. So so I'm certainly grateful for the work they're doing, and it's growing very quickly. But I think that there are ways of bringing this message where, and the most important thing is that we're living it and that we're speaking to people, not down at them. Anyone who's eating animal food is not love, that we're condemning them, blaming them, or shaming them, or trying to lay a guilt trip upon them that, in the sense that we're superior and they're inferior, because that, I think, is just not effective. That we're called to live what ahimsa is and to awaken, not only awaken out of the culture of trance of eating animals, but then to also to awaken out of the whole mentality that goes on with it, of materialism, for example, and of the domination of the feminine, as another example, and disconnectedness and competition. These are huge constellations of attitudes that are still in people, even if they go vegan. I think we can all see it in the movement. We see a lot of infighting, and we see, I think in many ways, an unjustifiable reliance upon science to prove things when I think, really, we don't need scientific proof to know that we're healthy or that animals suffer or that the earth is being destroyed by animal agriculture. It's just really obvious. For us living in an RV, it's obvious that animal agriculture is enormously violent and clearly unnecessary and ridiculously wasteful. So we don't need science. I mean, science is helpful, but you've got to remember that the original science was basically men trying to figure out how to manipulate animals scientifically so that they would give more meat and more milk and to get females to give more babies. And science has been used basically to justify and to facilitate and to legitimize in many ways the whole herding culture. It's one of, and so has religion. Both science and religion are, as I say, the sons of the herding culture. They legitimize and support a lot of what we see happening in our world today. Although, of course, on the other side of the coin is the fact that we do have authentic religious teachers and teachings that question the herding culture. And we have authentic scientific studies that are done that question eating animal foods and show the devastation of to our environment and so forth. So these are tools that certainly we can use and that should be used for sanity and not for insanity, but they unfortunately can be used in a reductionistic way that just deepens our enslavement to the herding culture. So so I think this word herderism is a good word in the sense that it has within itself an arrow that points to why this mentality is in us, that we're products of a herding culture, and that we're not only products of a herding culture, but we're also proponents of a herding culture if we eat this stuff and teach our children to do the same thing. All right, so so essentially we're in a position today, I think, and one of the things I really wanted to talk about in the call tonight, since Anna also has brought this up, and it seems to be coming up a lot in my life lately, is religion, and especially yoga, and especially dairy, and the mistreatment of female animals, and to understand what's really going on in that system, because I think there's still quite a bit of room for us to understand more. So I want to talk a few minutes about that, and then go through some of the other issues that I think we're facing right now, this month. And then, of course, if you have any questions or comments, anyone has something you'd like to contribute, please press star 6. Now, lately, just the last couple of days, I've been writing an article on why it's so important for people who are in yoga to be vegan. And I was asked to write an article about this for the Integral Yoga magazine, and then synchronistically for another magazine in Hawaii. And so I've been writing this article, and I've been thinking about it. And this is something I've been thinking about anyway for a long time, as you all know, I think. Probably something we've all been thinking about. But the many layers of this, I think it's important to really make an effort to understand them. And the basic idea, a few things probably are somewhat shocking to people, beyond the fact that eating dairy products is not good for our health and for the environment and for the animals. And so I think when, you know, in a nutshell, when people talk to us about the fact that in Ayurveda, for example, it's very important for us to eat some dairy to be healthy, and that we have the most spiritual country in the world, which is India. I'm not sure if that's true, but a lot of people, you know, think that, that everyone eats dairy there. So eating dairy must be sort of a very basic part of human life. And I know that when I've spoken with groups that are based in Indian teaching, like the Hare Krishnas and the Jains and the yoga communities and so forth, I mean, we're talking about millions upon millions of people who are in these movements and who are following teachers, and both not only people from India, but a lot of Westerners really are very much in these movements, and they're eating dairy because this is something that these teachings promulgate, the importance of dairy. So how do we actually effectively address this? And I think, first of all, it's important to recognize and to articulate the fact that these traditions typically are all discouraging of eating the flesh of animals, or of eating fish, or of eating, which are, of course, the flesh of animals, but the flesh of both land animals and marine animals, and also critical of eating eggs. And the reason for that is these are typically considered to be polluting foods. The violence inherent in them is pretty obvious. You have to kill an animal who wants to live. This forces us to disconnect from our kindness and compassion, forces us to be vicious and abusive. We're stealing the eggs, and an egg is basically a life. Traditionally, and so we're killing. It's really killing. And an egg really is a little piece of meat, essentially. So I think in many ways it's not really a big argument that human beings, to live in peace on this earth, need to stop eating meat and eggs. But the problem very often comes with dairy because it's not quite so obvious. And so I think there's so many levels to talk about the violence in dairy products, and I would say that there's this is much probably more violence in a piece of cheese than in a piece of flesh, in the sense that the dairy cow, in order to produce that piece of cheese, is going to be chained, essentially almost immobilized. I mean, dairy cows really, for the most part, the vast overwhelming majority, over 90%, are indoors their entire lives and very often can hardly move. And so, and it's not just for a few months. Like for meat, it's typically only a few months before they're killed. But they have to live for 4 or 5 years in these conditions, even though they were 25 years, 4 or 5 years, they're still just young when they're killed. But still, that's a long time to be horribly confined and abused. I've mentioned the Conflict Dairy video. If anyone wants to, it's only 3 minutes or 3.5 minutes long. It's very short, but it's the longest 3.5 minutes I think I've ever spent was watching the unbelievably horrific abuse of dairy. I mean, just the, you know, what workers do to dairy cows, because dairy cows typically, not only do they not do what you want them to do over time, you know, they're large, powerful animals that we're all resisting, and so we've always resorted to violence and force to get them to do what we want them to do, and to steal their babies against their will, and of course the babies don't do what we want them to do, and so workers are not paid well, and they're in an environment that basically encourages them, since they're just by themselves, to be violent, and so they do terrible things, and you can see that in that, it's a small family dairy, basically, the Conflict Dairy video, and there's been other videos have come out since then that all corroborate the same thing. So it's important to realize, first of all, that animals who give milk, like cows, sheep, and goats, do not do that unless they're impregnated. And a lot of people just don't even know that, I discovered recently. I always thought that people knew that these animals have to be impregnated in order to lactate, but a lot of people don't even realize that these animals just give milk. So part of our education should be to just tell people these animals have to be impregnated against their will on what the industry refers to as rape racks. And these are this is a very uncomfortable experience for an animal. As you all know, they're probably, but if you don't know, I'll just tell you quickly. The method is to put the right arm all the way into the anus of the cow, all the way up to the shoulder, long plastic glove, and then you have sperm and a sperm gun that go into the vagina with the left hand, and then the right hand is pushing down somehow and palpitating the uterus so that it's more likely that the sperm will get what it's supposed to get. And so, this is done routinely, and I remember a woman telling me, actually, that had just a few cows, just a very small operation, one of those sort of idyllic operations, but she told me that when she would have a veterinarian come to impregnate the cows, and when the cows heard that the sound, they knew the sound of his particular pickup truck, and when they heard the sound of his pickup truck, they ran as far away as they could go. And so if they're able to, they certainly do not want to go through this. And then after 9 months of being pregnant, like us, they give birth to a baby and want more, nothing more than to be able to nurture that baby. It's important to understand, I think, that a cow will normally give birth to four babies. They're usually allowed to be impregnated four times, typically, on any dairy, organic or not. And three out of those four babies will be killed, either immediately or a little later, typically for veal. And so when people say that male calves are vealed and female calves are used for milk, that's really not true. I mean, it's an oversimplification. It's three-quarters of the calves are vealed or killed right away, whether they're male or female. The odds are, statistically, it would be two-thirds male and one-third female are vealed or killed immediately. And they're killed basically for their flesh, which is either veal or, if they're killed right away, they can be ground up for meat also. And for their skin, calf skin is valuable on the market. And then the fifth baby, and then also for the rennet in their stomachs, which has always been used and is still used as a coagulant for cheese. So they're killed for these things, and they're also not given any milk. I think it's good to know that they're given, instead of getting their mother's milk, they're given soy milk that's mixed with blood and mixed with some additives. Basically, cow's blood and soy milk and additives are given to these calves. And so it's really, I think, I don't know what to say. I mean, it's terrible that the dairy industry, I mean, it's hypocritical, really. The dairy industry, in some of its ads, mocks and makes fun of soy milk, for example, when they are purchasing huge amounts of soy milk to feed to the calves that should get their mother's milk. But they're one of the largest purchasers of soy milk there is the dairy industry, but, who knows, they buy probably a lot more soy milk than even human beings do to feed all these calves, soy milk, they buy, I'm sure it's powder and mix it with blood, whatever, but anyway, that's what they do. They use a soy milk base to feed to these poor calves that they're going to then hyper-confine so they can't even move and then kill. And so it's females as well as males that are killed. It's soy milk. And then the other thing that's important to understand is that it's a very common procedure for the farmers to time it so that the cow has impregnated one last time, so she's pregnant when she goes to slaughter. So they don't want to just send a cow to slaughter who's not pregnant and close to being ready to deliver. So maybe after 8 months, they're sent to slaughter. And so because there's a calf inside the mother that they can also kill after they kill her and get more wren and more flesh and more calves again. So and they don't have to go through the bother of having a baby born. So it's just profitable to do that. So this is a system that is really obscenely heartless and violent and full of sexual abuse on every level. I mean, these poor cows not only are impregnated against their will, and their babies are stolen, but there's also the other sexual violence that goes on by workers, which is documented, just sexual abuse of these cows. And then in addition to that, there's the perversion of the of acquiring sperm, which is also, you know, this male bulls that are kept in hyper-confinement, where they have to perform sexual acts on other males, on steers usually is what it is, or maybe they're just manipulated by workers manually to get sperm. I mean, this is all really sexual perversion forced onto these animals by human beings because we want to drink milk, and this is also for sheep and goats as well, not just cows. How is it that we would do this and not, you know, how can we allow this to continue, this kind of violence on such a massive scale, and have it be considered wholesome? You know, milk, there's nothing more wholesome practically in the mind of the advertising, vulnerable public than milk. We give it this wholesome kind of look. So there's more. I could say more, but I'm going to stop here because it gets even more perverse. But I've said enough already. But this is the level of what goes on with dairy from the level of what we're doing to these poor animals. The violence and the domination of the feminine, sacred feminine, and the breaking up of families. I mean, for yoga practitioners who essentially are on a path of spiritual awakening and of purification, to be eating dairy products is a complete opposite of everything, of all the teachings, obviously. And because something has been validated by tradition does not make it right, as we all know. So we have a situation where, you know, Krishna apparently was a herder, or was had these cows, and that's used as an excuse or as a rationalization for having milk, and the beneficial health qualities of milk are also talked about quite a bit. And yet it's just the opposite, really. And first of all, the two main points are, number one, to always remember that any religion, whatever religion it is, if it's going to be widely accepted in a society, it cannot go against the basic underlying orientation of that society. It has to support it. It has to. So that's why we have religious myths and stories and so forth in the so-called sacred texts of any religion that support the underlying activities of that society, that validate them, that legitimize them. So there has to be, you know, Jehovah has to be somewhere in the Bible, of course, saying, you know, to you, I put the animals into your hands, eat them if you want to, but, you know, there's always these buts, you know, but don't eat their blood, or, you know, or there's other sayings that, you know, Jehovah loves to have the smell of these animals being burned, of course, you know, so we're doing it for God or for the Lord or something like that. So that's a rationalization. And we have similar things, of course, in, with Krishna and this idea that this is a gift from the gods and so forth, but there's inherent cruelty in animal agriculture and inherent cruelty in dairy. And I remember, for example, talking to a young Jain who went to India and really looked into the whole thing and went to families who have just one or two cows, and where everybody thinks that, well, you know, in that case it's okay, they're like part of the family, you know, they just stay right in the yard and they're just taken care of, and yet he found that if you just ask these people a couple of questions, number one, what do you do with the females when they stop giving much milk anymore, and number two, what do you do with all the male cows that are born after you impregnate them, they didn't want to answer those questions, or even the extra female cows, you know. They send them off to market, typically, or they let them go. They just let a lot of cows, if you've been to India, which I haven't, but, you know, it's common knowledge that there's a lot of cows wandering the countryside who are not owned. They're old and they're starving. Really, I mean, a lot of them just skin and bones, eating garbage and plastic and trying to, you know, survive. And they very often get picked up by unscrupulous traders who will then take them to other states where it's okay to kill them for their leather. But, I mean, India has the largest, not only the largest dairy industry in the world, but has the largest leather industry in the world, and it also exports more beef than any country in the world as well. So so they slaughter a lot of cows. And I think it's important to understand that it's always been suffering in dairy products. And Gandhi himself, back in the 1940s, if you read his autobiography, he talks about how he was disgusted to go and see farmers putting sticks in the vaginas of cows to make them give more milk and doing these kinds of things. This was common practice among farmers, you know, little family farmers. And so the abuse of animals for dairy is legendary, actually. It's something that's always been going on. It's not something that's avoidable. You're stealing something away from the calf, and you're imprisoning an animal, and that's what we do. We imprison them. We make them our property so that we can get something. That is slavery, and it's violence. It's a form of violence. And then the final thing to understand, maybe two more things just briefly. Number one, the environmental impact of all of this. You know, if you look at any analysis of environmental devastation caused by animal agriculture, dairy products are right near the top. I mean, you have beef, number one, lamb right up there, number one or two, and dairy right up there, number three. It's terrible. I mean, it takes a huge amount of grain, huge amount of water. It takes 1,000 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of milk. I mean, it's incredibly wasteful of water, energy, methane, nitrous oxide, global warming, greenhouse gases, and cutting down forests to graze animals, to feed them soy, to get dairy, cutting down rainforests, feeding fish to dairy cows. You know, the cows are eating huge amounts of fish to boost their milk production, just overfishing of the oceans, the killing of non-target species like dolphins and whales and birds and so forth and other fishes, all for dairy products because they eat a lot of fish meal. So the environmental devastation of dairy products is enormous. The cruelty to the poor workers, I mean, the workers are abusing the animals. They get perpetrator-induced traumatic stress disorder themselves. And if you have, you know, these workers that are electroshocking and kicking, horribly punching these cows, are also doing terrible things to other people and taking drugs themselves or alcohol and get thrown in jail and so forth. And it's very hard work. It's very dangerous work. You know, I remember reading a while back about, you know, these manure pits that they have on dairy operations where there's many different toxic gases that emanate from these pits. Besides methane, there's hydrogen sulfide and nitrous oxide and ammonia. And these are toxic, very, very toxic. They can kill people. And I remember it wasn't comical, but it almost sounded comical. You know, this guy was a worker at a dairy, I think it was in Oregon, and he went too close to the manure pit, and he died. And the fumes just, you know, he couldn't get away, and he collapsed and fell in. And then another worker went to try to find him and looked around and get too close to the manure pit, and the same thing happened to him. You know, and then two other guys went, and one guy, I think three were ultimately died before they finally stopped it. You know, and they saved somebody's life, but this kind of thing happened. You know, these kind of things happen. These are typically very often undocumented workers, and you don't hear too much about it. But there's enormous suffering of these workers and death that they endure for milk too. The slaughtering of these animals, if it's a small scale operation, they can be even more brutal than the large scale operation that I've talked about. And the fact that these animals are pushed so hard to give that they very often have osteoporosis, they're downers, they, you know, so these are dairy cows. So the cruelty involved in dairy is almost, it just, it never ends. And if it's organic, I talked about that, I think I told you about that, so I won't go into it, but basically organic, and this is well understood, there's even more cruelty involved than in commercial production, because you can't merely use antibiotics, for example, on their udders if they have mastitis, or on their skin if they have a rash. And so they'll use an implement like a corkscrew to manually ream out their tits if they get clogged up with mastitis, which is extremely painful. So these cows on organic dairies suffer actually much worse in many cases, according to veterinarians who actually work with them. I was talking to my friend Hope O'Hannock in Santa Rosa, and she actually went around with a veterinarian, and he said, yeah, absolutely, the cows suffer a lot more on organic dairies than they do in commercial operation. So organic just means that their feed is supposed to be organic, but it doesn't mean much more than that. So there's that. And then the final thing is just the health. From the health point of view, look, I mean, dairy has casein in it. You can't get the casein out. Casein is the most common, huge protein molecule that we don't have the basic renin like cows have, the enzymes to break down. And so no matter what Ayurveda says or anything else, it's linked to autoimmune diseases of various kinds, as well as to cancers of various kinds. It's also inflammatory. It's also acid-forming. And there's also IGF-1 growth hormone, which is known to be like throwing gasoline on the fire in terms of cancer growth, and as well as concentrating physical toxins, as well as concentrating the metaphysical toxins that I referred to, like you're concentrating heavy metals and PCBs and dioxins, and nuclear radiation now, of course, is a big concern after Fukushima. All of that concentrates in dairy products, but then on top of that you have the terror and fear and despair of these animals. So to do a practice of purification and cleansing and spirituality while we're eating meat, of course, but dairy products, I think exposes a real disconnect on so many levels. And the fact that we there's no nutrients in milk that we need to be healthy, and in fact there's so many hormones in there as well, that prolactin and estrogen. I mean, there's real estrogen. The men getting breasts and so forth is really, this is, and women having their menstrual cycle early. I mean, think of the devastation that's had on our society. Women should be getting their first menstruation around the age of 16, 17, 18, 19, somewhere in there, and yet because of dairy products, girls are getting their first menstruation at the age of 9 or 10, which and getting pregnant, teenage pregnancies, all these things come from dairy. It's just mind-boggling, the amount of suffering. And so I hope that yoga students will begin to demand that their teachers and that the movement of yoga in general just turn its back on this kind of traditional violence and domination of the feminine. You know, the whole religious impetus, especially in our culture today, which is a really patriarchal culture, it's about honoring the sacred feminine. It's about awakening the sacred feminine. It's about respecting the maternal instincts of love and protection and the capacity to be receptive. And dairy on every level is an absolute abomination and devastation to our physical temple, to the animal, to the ecosystems, to our consciousness. It's just over. It's time for it to really be seen for what it is. And I think before long, it'll be really, I mean, an awakening has to happen where it's understood that it's absolutely intolerable for someone to be leading a meditation retreat or a yoga retreat and serving cheese or butter or meat or eggs, any of these animal foods. The dairy products are absolutely as devastating, and even in many ways much more devastating than any other animal food. I have a couple of people that have raised their hands, so I'm going to press And then I'd like to love to hear your comments. And then there's a few other things I really want to talk to before we have to wrap it up here. But I really wanted to help everyone, if you are in conversations or sharing with people, other friends or colleagues or anyone about dairy, to, in a sense, realize we're on really solid ground to question dairy products on every level, that there's nothing, there's also casomorphines, because dairy products have naturally occurring morphine-like substances that are designed to just help people go to sleep, or help the cats go to sleep, actually. But they're physically addictive, so there's an addictive quality to dairy as well that I think is important to be aware of. Okay, Grace, I'm going to unmute your phone. Thank you so much for, if you still have, it was quite a while ago that you raised your hand, and I wanted to wait a little bit before we talked, but did you want to say something or at all? I have a question.
Yes, please, yes. First and foremost, thank you. You may remember that the chapter about the domination of the feminine is what broke open my heart and inspired me to veganism. A long time of being an ignorant and as an uneducated vegetarian. So thank you so much. It's so sad. It weighs heavy on my heart, but it's good to hear it again. I've mentioned this idea of the aborted babies. The last pregnancy doesn't end in a birth; it ends in an abortion at the slaughterhouse. I couldn't remember where I had read that or heard that, but hearing you describe that tonight gives me a lot of confidence that this is, in fact, a tragic and terrible thing that is happening, and that as I can just do my best to share with folks that this is an injustice we don't need to participate in.
Great.
Aside from that, yeah, thank you so much. Thank you very much. I did raise my hand a long time ago because I'm curious about the AR conference, at the end of the month, July into August, the farm group is having this national conference thing. I don't see you participating. There are only a couple of exhibitors or speakers that I would be interested in, and I'm not familiar with Interloca Animal Sanctuary. I'm kind of curious about them. But I was wondering, because you had Jonathan Balcombe on our call, I don't know, probably a couple of years ago, I would really like to see him in person. And Hope is going to be there on behalf of the United Poultry Concerns. I was wondering if you're going to have any presence there, or if there is somebody that you would recommend for certain that if I go, I'm going to meet my father up there. If there's anything in particular that I should see there. Okay, that's my question. Anything you want to share about the AR conference? And I'm sorry if I missed you publishing something about that already.
Great, okay. No, that's fine. Thanks, Grace. And I'm not going to the MOH conference this year. I went for many years. I actually broke the record for the most years of never missing the animal rights conference and speaking and playing the piano. Alex Hirschaff used to demand that I go to that conference from the very beginning, back in the 1980s. But the last few years, I haven't been going that much anymore. But I think the main thing is it's in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to be in California. And then, I'm kind of, I think it's a good, essentially it's a pretty good conference. There's, a little bit of, I have a friend who's on the board of the conference who's upset with them, with the leadership of the conference for having someone from the HSUS delivering, keynote lectures when they are clearly not an organization that is, it's such a welfareist organization that it's somewhat embarrassing, I guess, and considered by, I think, quite a few people to be counterproductive to have to honor them by, you know, giving them keynotes, speaking spots where everybody has to sit and listen to them. So there's some of that stuff going on in my mind too, a little bit. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, there's quite a few good speakers there if you want to. And for me, it's more, I guess, it's about sometimes, you know, meeting people and making connections and things. But just, you know, Karen Davis, I think, is wonderful. And I always like hearing her speak. And so I'm glad she's there. And also Mary Finelli from Fish Feel. I think she's got she's created an organization that's really for the fish, which I'm such a fish lover. And mm-hmm. I'm going snorkeling with the fish. So Mary's a good friend of mine, and I always like to see her. Also, Lester Friedlander, he's a really interesting guy. He is a former, he's a veterinarian and an inspector of slaughterhouses. And he's been into a lot of slaughterhouses, and he tells you what goes on there in slaughterhouses. And he was a whistleblower, and they hate him. They got rid of him, but he goes around and he talks about what really goes on in the behind the scenes in slaughterhouses as someone who's been there, you know, as a veterinarian and was an inspector. So those are some of the people I especially admire. I really also like Lisa Kemmerer. You know, she's a great writer, a vegan, and a professor, kind of into women's issues and also somewhat into spirituality as well. So I think there's a lot, you know, there's definitely some good people. Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs will be there, and I think he's excellent. I mean, he's a good friend of mine, too. Quite a few, good friends. Ingrid Newkirk, the founder of PETA, of course, will be there. She's quite interesting, which sometimes what she has to say, even though we don't always agree with everything that they're doing. But I think all in all, there's, quite a few, you know, respected people that I respect the work that they're doing who will be there. It looks like one of the biggest gatherings in a long time. I mean, every year they're big. I guess every year they grow a little bit, maybe. Jenny Brown will be there. I just was with her last weekend. She's the founder of the Woodstock Animal Sanctuary in upstate New York, and they've just moved to it's a former Methodist summer camp, something like, you know, 1,000 acres with all kinds of buildings. It's just amazing place. So she's doing a lot of good work, I think, on behalf of the animals too. So, I think, you know, it's up to you really, if you think it's worth your time to go. But it's a good place very often to make connections with other activists. And of course, there is an alternative one. Not this year. Let's see. This year, it's not this year. It's going to be 2016. In Berkeley, put on by Gary Francione and Bob Linden. And so that's the alternative one. I went to the alternative one last March in L.A., and it was pretty good, but I wasn't there very long. I had to just go for – I just gave a lecture and had to leave. But anyway, I think, you know, that's – I think they're both working. I think there's a lot of people doing great efforts, and I'd rather see less. Of course, less division within the movement and more everyone working to do the best they can. And I'm glad to see that, you know, I think that's happening, I think, more and more. So thank you, Grace. And I have a hand up from Tara, too. Tara, are you there?
I am. Hi.
Oh, great. Hi.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Will.
Good to hear you.
Yeah, good to hear you, too. Thank you so much. I also was very much affected by your chapter on the feminine in your book. I was one of those people that had no idea how dairy came into the world and what the cows
right.
were going through. As soon as I figured that out, then it was very easy to not partake in that anymore. But, you know, listening to you talk, I often kind of go off into the ether space and get these great ideas or revelation from what you're speaking of. Because I think you're speaking on many different levels. And what I started thinking about was really, what is the cow? Is there an archetype that is the cow? Because much of what we do, we're a way down the road, a long way down the road from what is right and good in this world right now. And we know that. And we're way far away from any connection to God, unless you specifically practice being in connection with your highest self or God. So what does this cow mean to us? What are we trying to get or suckle from the cow, those who are still eating dairy? And the cow is a symbol of the mother. And, you know, not so much our mother, but of what a good mother would be. And a vegan monk once told me that if you're ever craving dairy or creamy things, you're actually craving the love of your mother or of a mother. So what you've done, isn't that interesting? Yeah. And so what we're actually craving from the cow is a connection with the Divine Mother, I do believe, now that I think about it. And that, you know, like in the same way that we're all speaking on a telephone because we've forgotten how to communicate heart to heart, mind to mind. And so in that way, I mean that we're way down the road from being really in connection with our highest self. So when speaking with someone that is really craving dairy, besides the addictive, physically addictive properties, there's some spiritual emptiness that maybe they're craving, and then it might help them to be in connection with or find out what is the Divine Mother or Sophia, you know, our Divine Feminine, and nurture that part of our body, of our spirit, to help break the addiction to this secondhand Divine Mother fluid that is milk.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Tara. That's an interesting idea, you know, and I think it's probably good just to put it in the hopper, let everybody meditate on that, and maybe make sense in a sense, because, you know, there's the irony, of course, is that it's our violence towards these cows and other animals, probably more than anything, shutting down our connection with the Divine Feminine. So we crave the Divine Feminine, so we want to have more cheese, which is more violence for these poor animals. And so it's definitely very ironic, the whole thing.
It is ironic, but, and we've really we've violated the entire thing that we're craving. We have violated the mother.
Right.
Is the craving of the mother. You know, something else interesting that I've noticed a correlation with is that India is one of the largest consumers of dairy, and the sexual violence there has gotten really horrible.
Right.
And I think there's a direct correlation with the losing connection with the Divine Mother, which they are from birth. They're taught, you know, that connection, and they love the Divine Mother and all the forms of the feminine. But they're getting another message through the milk that they're drinking, and it's coming out in the form of violence. So that's all I wanted to say.
Well, thanks, Tara. Awesome. We need to kind of wrap up here at 7:30. But thank you so much. I'll talk to you later. Thank you. Wow, that's so great. Yeah, so, all right. So at this point, it's 7:30. I wanted to do so much more. Sorry I talked so long about the dairy. And there's still more I didn't say. I could have said some more, but I'm going to actually stop there because we can go on forever just on dairy. It's just really, I think it just never ends. I wanted to mention just in the July resources for the World Peace Diet Circle sheet that I put that you all have, I prepared for you for this month, which is basically a lot of articles and that are on the internet. I wanted to go through a few of those because I think, just briefly, say a couple words.
You'll see there's quite a few, several videos that I put up and articles and so forth. Also, some of our facilitators, Marlene Narrow, Sandra Higgins, Marcus Nyland, writing blogs and having videos and having, Marlene has a wonderful weekly vegan radio show called Vegan Nation. I've been on that and many other, people who are vegan, spokespeople and so forth. She's been interviewing and it's highly recommended. Sandra Higgins in Ireland, she has her own, she's a facilitator with her own, sanctuary there and is a very eloquent, spokesperson for animals. She's a psychotherapist, works a lot with people's, emotional issues and the violence towards animals. And so please check these things out. Vegan ultra runner Scott Jurek ran the Appalachian Trail. I think you all know him probably. Scott Jurek, the great vegan ultra marathoner. He's getting up there in years. He's not really in running anymore, but he just set a new world record for running the Appalachian Trail in the shortest amount of time ever. I mean, that's amazing. He just did it in 46 days and 8 hours. And he did it as a vegan to really proclaim veganism. So I think that's a wonderful thing. There's some other things here. Chris Hedges, I've talked a little bit about him. There's a very important study here that was published recently that linking slaughterhouse workers with an increase in violent crimes in an area. So when you have a slaughterhouse moving into an area, you have an increase in violent crimes, and this is documented in a recent study. We've been saying that for years, but it's always interesting to see the new studies that are showing this to be true. There's also a very kind of sad article about slavery among fishermen in Thailand. These Thai fishing vessels, and they're selling the fish right here in the United States, right here in Kroger and Safeway and Whole Foods, everywhere else. But the fishermen come, they're from Burma and other countries, and once they get on one of these ships, they go far away to Indonesia, and they cannot get off the ship. They kill them, or they beat them and terrify them. And so people are in slave conditions for decades on these ships to get fish. So, I mean, this is, again, the dark underside of animal agriculture, what's going on. There's also this great, it's something completely different, but there's a couple of these right now that are going viral on the internet. Little kids that are going crying and tearful when they realize that they're eating animals. And this one is this little girl. She's a 5-year-old, and she makes the connection. I think she's from Ireland. And so anyway, it's interesting to see. Many of us probably on some deep level can resonate with that moment when we discovered what we're eating. We're eating animal people. I don't want to eat animal people, she says, She starts crying. Bad. And then there's also the full text of Pope Francis's recent encyclical. I think it really is, even though he's not a vegan, it would have been great if he would say he would do something, but a lot of the ideas that he proposes are wonderful. I mean, he really talks about the importance of more respect for animals, respect for nature, respect for workers, to not allow corporations and financial institutions to devastate the landscape of our society, and that animals deserve respect. I think really it's great to see him writing that, actually. A nice article by Keith Akers about the decline of Christianity in our society and what does that mean. A few other, other ones that are kind of interesting. The dangers of not eating a vegan diet. Sometimes these people from the Western Aid Christ Foundation will write something. The dangers of a vegan diet, it's such poppycock that they write. It's really so ridiculous. They're grasping to find some evidence of people who are vegans not being healthy. And of course you can find some evidence of that. But essentially, there's these great articles coming out by doctors and other people saying the dangers of not being vegan, which are far, far, far greater. And also an article about a doctor who was apparently killed for speaking out against vaccines. One of the things I think is important to remember, that vaccines are tested on animals. They contain animal products that are not vegan. And I think they are in many ways a devastation that started with being used on animals to control animals. They're now being mandatory not only for animals but for humans. And this sense, like this recent law that passed in California, that we don't have as parents the right not to have our kids vaccinated if they're going to go to school. You know, this mirrors in many ways, I think, the mentality of cows. I mean, that, you know, when a mother cow gives birth to a baby, it's not her baby, it's the owner's baby and the exploiter's baby. We have to be careful that we don't allow the same mentality in our society as well. So anyway, those are some of the things. There's more on there too. And I really love this little cartoon at the end where this woman has a shopping cart that's absolutely overflowing with vegetables and bread and fruit and all kinds of things. And this woman says, "Oh, really? No," she has a vegan t-shirt on. It says, no meat or eggs or cheese. My goodness, what do you eat? She's got so much food there. So I want to thank you all so much for joining us. This time somehow slipped away again this time. And I would like to especially draw everyone's attention to, again, to the Indiegogo campaign of Mark and Anna for the World Peace cookbook and the World Peace yoga book and the World Peace diet cuisine line of foods to support them. And that, I think, it's a worthy cause. And it's great that we see so many people working so hard to help create a better world. I want to draw everyone's attention again also to Lily Macy and the every Sunday, World Peace Diet Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. There's a phone number. It's an excellent tool to meet with like-minded people. Anyone you know who's maybe interested, who's maybe not yet a vegan or who is a vegan or would like to have some support if you're feeling a little bit alone, it's an online community right there. I mean, it's a teleconference. It's not really online. It's a telephone conference community where the World Peace Diet is read together, and then there's discussion also afterwards. So it's a fantastic way to introduce people to the World Peace Diet. I was really hoping to talk with Lily actually today on this call, but it's really too late, unfortunately. So I'm going to tie a string around my finger for next time when we're in Switzerland at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we can, I'd love to hear some more from Lily because that is really taking, again, a life of its own. It's very positive and highly recommended also. And there's lots of other wonderful things being done by World Peace Diet facilitators. Thank you. There are several people who have volunteered to work with Tara to help create an online database of World Peace Diet facilitators and people who are doing study groups and where we are located around the country and around the world. So we're going to be working on that slowly but surely, and we'll keep you posted about that too. So we have some technical things that we need to improve with our mailing list and website, and I apologize, sometimes people don't get mailings from us. We have to do some upgrading of our system, and we're looking into ways of doing that. And it's not that easy when you have a system that we've been using the same system for over 10 years, about 10 years, I guess. So there's quite a bit that we need to look at. But anyway, hopefully things will be getting better on that level as well. Our great friend Stephen Goodwin, who is from France, has translated the World Peace Diet into French. He then turned around and translated the World Peace Diet into German. He then turned around and found a publisher for the French edition and found a publisher for the German edition. Now he's creating the index for the French edition, and he's just a real benevolent force in the movement here to get the World Peace Diet into other languages. He's created websites for these pages and may perhaps be working as my translator when Madeline and I go to France, the French part of Switzerland and so forth. But next year we're hoping to get to France possibly, so we'll be doing some more traveling next year. And then also just a reminder to everyone that this year, starting on November 15th, we're planning on going on about a 11-month tour of North America, doing lectures on the World Peace Diet all over Eastern and United States as well as Midwestern United States. So we're going to be doing that. So let us know if you'd like us to do something in your area, and we're probably going to be going to Africa, to South Africa anyway. We have several World Peace Diet facilitators in South Africa, and we're thinking it'd be a good time to maybe do that. So those of you who know people there, we'll be doing that probably if all things work out. So we look forward to hearing from all of you in between if you have any questions or concerns. And then, of course, next month, which will be August, the third Thursday of August, is the 20th. And August 20th is an interesting day. We'll be flying from Geneva to Rome. So we'll be in Italy, actually. So we'll see how that goes, but we'll try to keep things going. If anything has to change, I'll let you know between now and then, but we'll plan on that. And so heartfully gratifying to know that each and every one of you is in the world with us and that we're working together to help bring a world of greater peace and understanding that we can share together. Please let me know if you have any, as I said, any questions or comments in between. You can always email me at willcuddle@earthlink.net or just go to worldpeacediet.com. You can always send an email right on the website. And we look forward to more ideas and more collaboration. Let me know. I was thinking maybe we might do a live World Peace Diet Facilitator training again. We're thinking of maybe doing one at the farm in Tennessee next year and maybe also doing one in California. Maybe doing a coaching program. That might be another, that's another thing for people who want to get certification as coaches. We can, there's different possibilities. I should be careful not to get overextended here, but I'm so excited about the possibilities, and I think that as things unfold, we'll be able to continue to open the doorway for greater understanding in our society. Make sure, though, that we get enough time for meditation, contemplation, connecting with nature, being creative, loving our loved ones, spending time with our loved ones, having a morning program. I think it's really helpful where we really tune into our life and our precious opportunity and not allow ourselves to be overcome with the details of life. But remember, the most important thing is to connect with our spiritual resources and the inner quietness, the inner stillness that's always shining, from which the wisdom and compassion that can guide us in our lives emanate. Much love to you all, and I wish you a wonderful month. And I think I squeezed in probably a little too many words here today, but I appreciate you all, and thanks for all the efforts you're making. Much love to you all, and thanks for joining us.